Let's get started. Welcome everybody to our Senate meeting this afternoon. And you see there are the land acknowledgement statement and the rules we have for running the meeting. Next slide, please. It's sort of sad that every one of our meetings now for the last month and a half or so, we want to begin with a statement because bad things are happening out there. In this case, it's some horrific new COVID-19 waves that are happening across Europe, India, Bangladesh, and so on. And we're, of course, awfully all sad to hear about that news. And we must remember also that in our midst are students and staff and faculty from those very areas. And we want to acknowledge our sympathy, our empathy for what they're going through. It's all, of course, magnified by this time of the academic year where we're all stressed to begin with. Next slide, please. Next. So I have a sad announcement that Mike Toney, an animal professor in animal science, DGS, a senator, and also somebody who has worked with us over the last year on the university faculty committee, passed away last week from cancer. Mike was a researcher in CHEEP, as you can see from the pictures there. And one of his more recent activities concerned having a solar farm and a sheep farm on the same land. The last time I saw Mike was in person was a few months ago at the Trip Hammer Wine. As you might know, that Mike was a real stickler with Robert's rules, and I play fast and loose with Robert's rules. So we had exchanged some quips in the checkout line about that. Anyway, he's going to be missed. It's really nice to have a foil like Mike around. He had great insights in all our doings this past year in the USC. So Mike Thoney. Next slide, please. As you know, the election completed last Friday. Eve DeRosa will be the next dean of faculty, and you can see the individuals who were elected to the other positions. And we want to thank all who ran for these positions, and of course, all who voted. Next slide, please. This is spread over the last sort of academic year. We want to have a greater faculty presence in the admissions business. So we set up a very lightweight group called the Admissions Advisory Group, who will meet roughly twice a semester with the Vice Provost and for Enrollment, who meets regularly with all the admissions officers from the colleges. So this will start in the fall. And I think it's an important development. This is clearly a critical area. And this is a nice low overhead way for faculty to stay in touch. And we'll have more information on how this operation will work, but I just wanted to announce that. Next slide, please. In 2 weeks, we have our last meeting. Here's just a sketch of what will happen. So President Pollack will be with us for Q&A. The Financial Policy Committee will give its annual report, okay? A couple of heads up on new things that are coming down the pike, Latin honors and the freshman writing seminar ballot system are important discussion points. And then we want to tidy up partly some of the things that have been going on. We want to wrap up the international dual degree program approval thing. It will package it up as a resolution, and it would be good to act on that. We the tenure track project is going to have to be shipped into next year, but I want to do one thing before that happens. One of those resolutions has to do with the transparency of college documentation and I think that would be very important to get passed if we can, so that it sets a nice clean stage for Eve and others to work on this in the upcoming year. And there was a group and sort of an ad hoc group that was working on online harassment, and they produced a one pager. We'll talk about that next meeting. Next slide, please. Okay, so now we get into the main business for today. And just a couple of, a little bit of a preamble before we get into the presentations. There's six resolutions that we have to talk about. But let me say a few things in advance of that. Next slide, Joe. Okay, so this is a metaphor, but it's one that I like, all right? So it's been a really hard year in this respect, but we should not be surprised about that. These are hard conversations. You're supposed to feel uncomfortable. The destination is important, but you know how we get there, how we are getting there is even more important, right? We all have to learn how to talk about these things, talk about these things when you totally disagree with whoever you're chatting with. And I would just sort of say that there's an easy way to do this kind of thing, which is this kind of blue ribbon committee. You don't really look at any of the details. You just cruise along with the, you know, all the standard kind of discussion. We really dug deep, right? And we wouldn't be having this meeting, for example, if we took the easy way towards this. So I know that we're all, a lot of us are stressed about this. But on the other hand, I'm really kind of proud of that we took this route. And I'm just speaking for myself, and I know lots of others have told me that, you know, we've learned a lot. I have learned an awful lot about this. So I think we want to just keep that in mind today and going forward. Next slide, please. As you know, the C resolution passed. It was a pretty strong majority, sort of a 4-to-1 ratio there. Comments were a part of the ballot, as you know. You voted, and you also had a little box where you could write anything you wanted in there. We got about 20 or so comments. Most of them were people who had some kind of hesitation over the idea of having this center. And it's a two-pager. It's really interesting to see what those hesitations were. So anyway, that's done. We haven't actually sent that to the president and provost yet. We want to send all three things in one kind of package. But anyway, that's how the C resolution turned out. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's the format, roughly. We're going to do this 6 times. So somebody is going to present very briefly a resolution, okay? We want to sort of suggest something that, when someone's presenting, you sort of want to pay attention. You know, it's kind of aggravating if you're on chat, then you raise your hand with a question that was already answered, right? So I would sort of say when someone's actually presenting stuff, it's really better to listen than the chat. I know I'm sounding like a middle school teacher here, but that's kind of an important point. Then we want to make sure senators have a chance to pose questions. Because remember that the ultimate goal of this particular meeting is to make sure that all the senators know what each of those 6 resolutions says, okay? And then once that pool is exhausted, we'll open it up to discussion for anyone who's in the meeting. Next slide, please. Okay, so just a little preview. The plan is that the e-vote will start tomorrow. Tomorrow it will run for a week, and on each resolution you'll see something like this. It's just like with the center, the actual yes, no, abstain boxes at the top. A comment box that you can put anything you want in there. And just a reminder, it's totally anonymous. It is not coupled to your vote. We simply print out all the comments made, when the vote is complete. And they're going to be public. Okay, they're going to be public. And of course, you can sign your name there. All right. I think it's excellent if you do, as a matter of fact. But in any case, the comment box, and then below is the actual resolution, okay? And the resolution might have links in it. That'll be a carbon copy of what is on the resolution webpage. Okay, so it's the kind of thing where you might want to do a little bit of homework in advance because there's 6 things to process there. Next slide, please. Okay, let's just pause right here. Are there any questions about what I just said? Any of the procedure we're doing here? Were there any hands up there, Joe? No. Okay. I see Joni, then Richard. Joni?
Thanks. Just a quick question. I do see the point about encouraging people to pay attention and not to chat, but there are not Robert's rules that pertain to chat. And sometimes the chat also is a... Interesting stuff happens there too. It lets us happen in stereo sometimes, I think.
Yeah. Joni, just be clear, we're just sort of saying when someone's presenting their slides, you know, after that, clearly, I totally agree with you. The chat has been a very interesting feature that we've discovered in the last month and a half. No effort to quell that. I'm just sort of saying you might want to pay attention when someone's speaking. But that's all I'm saying.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Richard, yeah.
Hi, Charlie. I have a question about, want to propose an amendment to the UFCF resolution.
Yeah.
And it's unclear to me in the description of the process when we should do that. Should we do that after the presentation of the UFCF resolution, or should we wait to the end? I mean, when the parliamentary procedure here is really unclear. So that's the question.
What was perfectly clear, though, is I sent all the senators a note yesterday saying if you have any issue with the plan that we had, that you send it to us in advance. It is very hard to orchestrate spontaneous resolutions from the floor, and you were asked yesterday to send something. So it would have been nice if you had sent that yesterday. However,
Charlie, I did send you a heads up at 2 o'clock. We were still deliberating. I'm sorry about that, but you know, as you pointed out sometime before, it's hard to have all the trains run on time and 24/7. So I apologize for that, but it is under parliamentary procedure. Amendments are in order, Charlie.
Okay, so after we present, after we go through the UFC presentation, and we have as you know, we plan for an amendment already, all right, and it's all out there for people to look at, and we'll do that. And then after that, if you want to raise another issue, go ahead. You'll have to propose an amendment. It'll have to be seconded, and then we'll see if there's a majority that wants to go along with it. Okay, let's go to
Thank you very much, Charlie.
Yeah, now we'll go to the F resolutions. And you know, you've heard us, first of all the presentations are pretty brief in terms of the number of slides. Each one maybe 3 or 4 slides. So, and you've heard from us before, but let's just say a few final things about this. So one thing I wanna point out is that the faculty and the student pieces are highly related. If you look at the comments out there, very few people point this out. Now, there are 150 comments on the F report and about 20 on the S report, which is kind of an interesting ratio, okay? But the two are highly related. And again, some of the comments really point this out for different, totally different reasons. But I just want to stress two things here. If you look at the goal of the student requirement and change two words, that basically is a paraphrase of what the resolution, the UFC resolution is for faculty, okay? It's for faculty to become critical thinkers, okay? And again, when you start getting into the more practical things, for example, with the students, you know, menus, choice, learning from experts, classroom and workplace climate, tight schedule, rollout, resources, there's the whole parallel set of issues with faculty, and sometimes they're related. So a question I would pose to people is that how would you rationalize supporting one and not the other? I'm just posing this as a study question, okay? Regarding this kind of interesting ratio of comments, I want to mention something that some of you may not know, which is that anybody anywhere can post on our website. Okay, it's not just Cornell IDs, right? I'm not saying anything about what fraction of these are from the outside, but you should be aware of that. And in fact, we're gonna. It's Eve's call for next year, but my recommendation is that we really change the commenting feature on the website so it's only Cornell IDs people that can do it. So again, there's another sort of study question down there. Why do you think that the ratio is sort of 10 to 1 that way? Okay. Next slide, please. Okay, again, the versions of this have been discussed before, but when we vote, we're sending a signal, right? After this meeting, there's someone from the National Review that wants to talk to me. There was an editorial in Newsweek this morning about what we're doing, okay? People are watching, and of course on campus, right? Students are watching, staff and so on. So let's look at that first point there. Again, I'm posing these as questions. I don't know the answers, but I'm sort of encouraging people to think about these questions. What does this say about the faculty, all right, the core of the university, if it resists required education for itself while advocating for more of the same for both students and staff? Okay, what does that mean? Okay, the second point here, I'm again posing these as questions. All right, and when I'm done, we can get opinions on these. What does it say about the faculty if it regards accountability as a mechanism for coercion and an excuse for sanctions while other professions, critical professions, ongoing education and credentialing are seen as important? So these are, again, questions I would hope everybody has sort of thought about. Okay. Next slide, please. And this is my last one. So there's a fork in the road here, all right? And so at the top is this. So, you know, these are valid points of view, all right? You know, despite current events and realizations, adequate DEI progress is possible through voluntary programs, as we know it. Okay? Maybe you want to dial them up a bit, but one school of thought is that despite how things have changed over this past year in the country, all right, if you still feel that the current way we do these things, which is through voluntary programs by a number of excellent offices, is still a viable approach. There's another school of thought that says because of all these current events and realizations, progress is only possible through something more than voluntary. Okay? So that's kind of how I see the fork in the road. And again, I hope everybody thinks about that fork in the road and has a justification for the prong that they take. Okay. That's it. Let me just double check. Jill, the next. Yeah, okay, let's back up or take down the screen. And now we'll do a Q&A. And about time. I think we'll probably be able to end by 5, but maybe not. But I did mention last night that let's be relaxed. And if we have to go to 5:30 or even beyond, let's just get this done. We want to set the stage. It's time to vote, and we got to set the stage for that. Okay, are there questions? Joni?
Thanks, Charlie. But this is more a comment than a question. But you were asking why are there so many more comments about the F report than the S report?
Right. Yeah.
I think it's clear. It's the way the F report is written. It begins by saying that faculty must do this. And what this is not described, and the report also does not offer a rationale for why faculty should do this, rather not completely described thing. And then it suggests penalties for faculty not doing this big thing. And so it's insulting to read. The way that the report for the students is written, it frames it as describing what the purpose of this education is, what the goals are, and instead of just saying you must do this, So I think that's just an automatic reaction that made it harder to discuss the issues.
So can I just ask you a question about the next step, of course? So a lot of times people say there aren't enough details here. And remember, this is the step one. There's a step two. Now, you may be cynical about the step two. You might think that the faculty are not going to be involved in how these things are implemented. So no one is saying, for example, if you look at those accountability things, if they have to be approved, they have to be implemented, they're going to come back to the Senate, right? So is that clear or not?
It is that the report is asking us to imagine this while the document isn't saying it. The document is it just, it could have been finessed better. And I think that the revisions that the offered today are helping us do that. And I think it's, as you say, it's been an interesting conversation, but it's a busy semester. Hard to get into these conversations. And this one was kind of a bump.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Richard.
Hi, Charlie. Is this the time to offer my amendment?
Again, this is disruptive. I mean, the whole point is these Zoom things are very hard to run. You have 2 minutes. Tell us what the amendment is.
Well, here. I can speak to it. But let's see, what's going on here?
We can hear you, Richard. We can hear you.
So the amendment, go to the queue, because I'm trying to get it on the chat, but I can't seem to get it to work. Okay, there it is. I move to amend, there's the text. I move to amend the UFC F resolution by striking everything after the second whereas and adding the following text. On that motion, I also ask for the yeas and nays. At that point, I should ask for seconds.
Second.
Now that we have the motion before, that's the amendment. And now I would like to send what the text would look like if the amendment were adopted. Okay, so going back, paste, and send. If the amendment were adopted, the UFC F resolution would then read, and so forth. Now, I would like to say a few words about why I proposed the amendment to the UFC F resolution. One important reason is that the UFC F resolution and the second Senator F resolution contradict one another. The UFC resolution would punish faculty for non-compliance with the training program, while the Senator resolution would make compliance voluntary. Because this is the central issue dividing the two resolutions, the best way forward, the most democratic way forward, is to pair them against each other and have the Faculty Senate democratically decide which one it preferred, whether it be mandatory with punitive elements or be voluntary with incentives. Recognizing that the two resolutions contradicted each other, the sponsors of the Senate resolution, in fact, proposed that they be paired against each other. However, the UFC thought best not to do that. I should emphasize that the amendment incorporates much of the language of the UFC F resolution, so much so that the major issue between the original version and the amended version, amended alternative that I am offering, is whether or not compliance should be voluntary. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that come up with that.
You're right. They're sort of, the two resolutions are opposite. So in terms of information conveyed, is it worth going through this pitting one against the other versus, someone will vote yes for one and no for the other? Won't those results communicate? Remember, this is not, we're sending a message, right? And the question is, does your thing going to send add greater clarity to this? So let's hear from other people.
No, Charlie, that question was addressed to me. So let me answer it. One of the problems here, is that all through this process, we've had a one-sided set of presentations, deliberations. We have not at any point been able to decide as the Faculty Senate democratically you know, any issue. This has been offered. It's been seconded. Yes, I think we should do it.
Carl? The topic here is Richard.
Thanks, Charlie. Yeah, sorry. Thank you. To answer your comment, I'm going back to your earlier remarks. I think the concern, at least for some of us, is the quality of the training. I would just quickly mention that I had the good fortune after the last meeting of attending the Through the Lens diversity training, which Thomas had recommended as excellent. I found it was absolutely excellent. At the same time, as we had discussed earlier, there's a mandatory training we have for, I think it's sexual harassment, which I feel is very corporate and wrong. So the question is, we have a history as to what kind of training we've received. In our resolutions, we're really trying to bring this down to the departmental level and include good feedback. And so please, when we get to that, I hope people will remember that. The other thing to say is this anecdotal, but as a faculty senator, I've been talking to our staff, and the staff is not totally happy with their training. So as a faculty senator, we work slowly, but we'll get the job done.
Ken.
Yes, thank you, Charlie. I wish I could speak to Richard's proposal, but it got clipped off partly, and I'm not sure how one could do that without it being given to us in a written form. So I'll start by just saying that I kind of object to it having been repressed in this way. My colleagues have expressed a range of views. Some have been quite silent on this. Others have been very negative. And what they're negative about has tended to be the requirement aspect of it, the fact that it's 2.5 hours without that being justified. I myself remember the all-day events that Frank Rhodes and Hunter Rawlings would organize on important topics. Those were excellent. They truly were valuable. Arguably, the reason that the S proposal gets less criticism than the F proposal is that in 2.5 hours, whether it's once a semester or once a year, you can't accomplish what you can do over a full semester, which is what the students would experience. And possibly people's sentiment is simply that 2.5 hours isn't adequate. It pays lip service to the real need. Now, of course, if we're going to do it a full day, you couldn't possibly require the same full day every year. But it does suggest to me that not enough discussion and debate has occurred around the format of this or the punitive elements that have been proposed. I don't know that what I've described in any sense is the majority view of my department. In fact, I think if there's a majority view, it's that somehow we should support the university to do the right thing here. But I do believe that there are serious issues with what's been put in front of us, and that the UFC proposal sweeps over those by simply saying that we support the spirit of it and encourage further attention to the question. I would much rather be voting on something concrete with strong debate and strong support.
Could I just interrupt for a second, Charlie?
Sure.
Because we have a motion on the floor, we actually need to address the motion first and deal with it before we can have a broader discussion. Unless you want to...
Well, Nima, if that's the case, could you possibly give Richard an opportunity to share the screen and project the full text of what he is proposing?
It's Jill, really hard for us to do that.
Richard, Jill, do you have Richard's slide?
You know, it's really hard for us to do that. These are all the problems with it's really hard, which is why we had asked for everything to be sent earlier. And it's interesting how sometimes, anyway, that I'm not going to go into that, but we should make a decision about whether we as a body should make a decision, because things are also up and down, whether we're going to be talking about the motion or we're going to be talking about things more broadly. I think we can, because we're breaking all rules. Richard's going to have to agree that we're going to actually decide whether we want to do that or not.
I've added the sections that...
Charlie, what would you like to do? Take something, take a vote in chat?
I think we ought to hear from Risa. Can we just go to have Risa? Then we have everything on the table. We have Risa will talk about the... Or sorry, it's Lawrence doing the... No, wait, who's doing... No, Risa's doing the 2F resolutions. Why don't we hear from Richard? Sorry, can we hear from Risa and then try to figure this out after that?
Okay. Is that okay with everybody? If you disagree, yell out no. If we don't hear anything, we're just going to go ahead and hear from Risa about the other two proposals that are on the floor.
Yeah. That's fine with me.
Yeah. Okay. The screen up, Jill, for Risa's presentations.
Okay. Thanks. I think there's a real, there's certainly an overlap between the two resolutions, the what's being called the faculty resolutions F1 and 2, there's a real overlap between what I'm going to say now about those and what Richard has provided in the chat with regard to the motion to amend the UFC resolution regarding faculty education. So my comments on the amendment, the proposed amendment, which has been seconded and actually on the floor, were going to be very similar to what I'm going to say now, but since I've been asked to do it more broadly, that is what I will do. So let me just say that if you would like to look in the chat, that Richard has, I saw, put in the rest of the resolution, of the motion to amend. And the amended UFC resolution that's been proposed is all in there. And as Richard said, that proposed amendment maintains certain aspects of the UFC resolution where there's significant agreement on goals, and then to a great extent substitutes the major difference in conflict is the question of the requirement and, you know, the punitive nature of the consequences accompanying the requirement if the requirement is not fulfilled as opposed to a voluntary requirement. And then, as you'll see in the proposed amendment, there also retains two of the resolved clauses, I believe it is, from the UFC's resolution with regard to maintaining faculty governance. So if people do want to look at that proposed amended UFC resolution, you'll see a real congruence between what I'm about to say and what's in that proposed amendment. All right, so I'm going to start then here with the first resolution. Here it's entitled Supporting Faculty Educational Programs to Address Issues of Racism and Systemic Injustice and to Enhance Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And then that one is the first one I'll deal with, and then I'll deal with the second resolution, which deals with voluntary participation. So could you advance the slide, please? Okay. So what I think is really important, and this is in this first resolution, is to identify what I think many of us across the board have been saying the whole time, which is that the goals are extremely important and we should take them seriously with regard to having a strong and effective institutional response to address issues of racism and systemic inequalities. Now, this is not a new problem. I realized that Charlie before was emphasizing, of course, that this past year, you know, has been so extreme with the terrible tragedies and the terrible police violence that has occurred and the impact of pandemic on communities of color that has brought, you know, in front of people who otherwise may have ignored these issues, have brought these issues forward. These are systemic, which means they are long-lasting problems. And we have always needed a strong and effective institutional response to them. And of course, we need them more now than ever. But this is a long-term problem. And what we need, and I think there's agreement on this, is a collective faculty commitment to both understanding and to addressing these systemic inequalities, to addressing issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, to try to make this this campus and this institution one that has, that shifts its own systemic inequalities, as well as teaching and learning and researching and engaging collectively as a faculty to advance those goals. And so the resolution also supports recognizing that we have initiatives, educational initiatives. Now I'm just talking about faculty ones. Of course, there are the student initiatives as well in terms of courses that will be discussed in a bit, but that we should build on the educational initiatives that the OFDD and colleges and schools have created. And we should recognize those and build on them and develop them further. And that faculty governance should be part of that. So we should engage the Faculty Senate and its committees in the process of developing university-wide programs for faculty education. I don't think anybody disagrees with anything on this slide. So let's move on to the next slide. Thanks. And so the resolved provisions in this faculty resolution F1 supports, it endorses and it supports the Working Group F report's goal to create educational programs to support faculty in creating an anti-racist, just and equitable climate for our campus community, quoting from the report. And it also supports both university and college school department level development of faculty education programs to address these issues. It also supports and it endorses departments and colleges working with each other and with the OFDD to evaluate participation rates and the effectiveness of these programs. We need evaluation and we need a collective response in this way to learn from each other and to build. And with regard to the governance issues, it supports the Faculty Senate with its standing committees to participate in the process of developing these kinds of university-wide programs for faculty education. So again, I would assume that virtually everybody would agree with this. And so I think we're ready to go on to the next resolution, where this is where we have the conflict, the contradiction with the USC proposal. So if we could get the next slide. Thank you. And we can move to the next slide as well. Okay. So again, the title here is very similar to the other resolutions, but of course it now includes supporting the resolution supporting voluntary participation by faculty in these educational programs. Next slide. And again, it starts with what does the resolution support? I'm not going to read these out again because the first two are exactly the same as what was in the first resolution with regard to the institutional response and collective faculty commitment. The third piece in terms of what's supported has been alluded to already, which is that this resolution supports a positive, non-punitive approach to achieving these goals of building and achieving broad participation in faculty education programs and doing it in a way that is designed to succeed in having a positive collective commitment where we encourage our colleagues and we create structures that will enhance that encouragement and really build deep discussions with each other. Next slide. And so the resolve clauses reflect the whereas clauses. The resolve clauses strongly encourage, will ask the faculty senate to strongly encourage voluntary participation by the faculty in these educational programs. It supports developing positive incentives for faculty to participate in these educational programs. What the scope would be of those positive incentives, that would be to be worked out. This is an example of something that could be a possibility, supplemental funding for departments. For example, you know, they could even be, such funding could even be earmarked for certain purposes to enhance the creation of these programs. But I'm just going to end with once again noting that what we want is success here. What we want is success in addressing something we all agree upon in terms of our goals. And to move towards success is as a positive matter, is inconsistent with a notion of mandating participation on pain of punishment, which is listed in the report, the working group F report at this point, the pain of punishment with regard to not being permitted to teach, not being permitted to advise students, not being permitted to do anything in our jobs. That is punishment. That could result in somebody losing their job. I don't think that's the way that we move towards a positive goal of inclusion and addressing deep systemic inequalities and actually engaging in self and collective education. So thank you.
Okay, let's, why don't we just continue just talking about the content of all these things. Durba and then Durba.
Thanks, Charlie. So I'm Durba Ghosh, for those of you who don't know me. I'm faculty in the Department of History. I'm a member of the University Faculty Committee. I'm in my second term. I'm also working a member of Working Group F. So maybe I'll just say one thing, which I think is very positive, which is we have in front of us several resolutions, which as Risa Lieberwitz just pointed out, which roughly agree that we should adopt some kind of faculty responsibility for educating ourselves on anti-racism. None of these resolutions are absolutely perfect. And I say this as somebody who was involved in Working Group F. There were a lot of conversations, a lot of difficult conversations, a lot of lack of resolution. And I think the shape of all of these resolutions reflects that. I hope we're acknowledging that this is not the end of the discussion, but an important next step that will lead to some form of implementation. I want to encourage the faculty senators who are going to vote, please vote yes for one or more of these resolutions. I think it will send a very important message to the administration about what we prioritize in terms of what we as a faculty are willing to do to make this a more equitable place to work and to teach and to do research. I've been hearing a great deal about not sending the administration a quote unquote blank check. I've also been hearing a lot of criticism of corporate style diversity seminars and trainings. And I think what I would say is I share that sense of criticism. And so in some sense, I see these resolutions as pressing forth a vision for what the faculty wants. And so again, vote for one of these resolutions, vote yes. One thing I'll just say about the Working Group F report is the word punitive or punishment doesn't really exist in the report. I just searched the report. And so one of the things that I would say is that the report is not calling for punishment, but promoting a process by which we are not in a position of punishing colleagues who make biased comments or conversations. Rather, the report is promoting forms of training to support faculty in helping them to be better at their jobs, all part of their jobs, running their labs, teaching courses, working with other faculty, working with staff. I have a preference in terms of the faculty requirement that does not depend on the voluntary goodwill of the people who are usually goodwilled. And I'll just say a word about the folks that have put forth these resolutions. The alternative resolutions. These are extraordinarily good-willed, kind, supportive individuals. And so I really, really, really appreciate the resolution. I prefer the one offered by Working Group F, in part because Working Group F was comprised of faculty and students of color. I prefer the one offered by Working Group F because it does not depend on the voluntary goodwill of the goodwill. I'll just end by reposting a comment that was in among the many comments that was posted in Charlie's, or I don't like to call it Charlie's website, but was posted in the chat. And that is a comment posted by a faculty member who was expressing opposition. I'll let you read it. These aren't my words, but their words. I sense as this faculty member is remembering with some fondness past moments in which they felt free to speak openly. This comment is built on a particularly resonant story about the past. And it's a story about the past that I hear a lot from some of my senior colleagues. What I understand from this narrative of loss sounds a lot like, quote, it used to be really great when we were less diverse and we could say what we wanted without being called out by minority and women faculty. I don't know if that's what this anonymous commenter is saying, but I think I would conclude by saying what Charlie opened with, which is having a diverse faculty and student population requires work. That work should not be a requirement for some of us. In proposing a faculty requirement, we're not calling for a restoration of the old order. We're not calling for a taking away. Instead, we're calling for the faculty to advance a future in how we change, how we teach, how we organize our labs, how we mentor, how we create equal opportunities for everyone. That change is already happening, but rather than being fearful of what you might lose, we might want to look toward a future in which all of us can speak freely and be heard. With that, I'll maybe just note that it's 4:20. We've been in this meeting for about 40 minutes. And I don't want to make too much of a big thing here, but I'm the first person of color that's spoken about this anti-racism measure. So in case you feel that everybody is free to speak, I would just draw attention to how extremely sturdy and brave I am today. And so I hope this is an invitation for some of my colleagues to speak up as well.
Thanks. Let's hear from Mark.
Sorry. I think I want to just cut and paste what Derbridge just said, so I'll pass. Thank you.
I guess, let's go down the list here and then get our way back to what we do with Richard's motion here. So, Carl?
So I would just quickly want to mention that appreciate what Durba said, but I'm thoroughly remembering in Working Group F that there were comments concerning what would happen to faculty who didn't have the mandatory training. There was talk about lack of any contact with students. Durba, could you answer that? I mean, that was a very real concern that was just expressed earlier. Not the impression I just got from you. Thank you.
Thanks for asking that, Carl. I mean, I think the passage that you're referring to, I was looking for it too, is at the end. And maybe I'll just give a little, I know you've already heard a lot about Working Group F. One of the things we were thinking about is that we already have training like the one you went to for search committee, for serving on a search committee. I think what we were imagining was that we would have workshops for the particular roles that faculty do. If you don't sit on a search committee, you don't go to the search committee training, right? If you don't run a lab, you don't go to the lab training, right? But this would be a way of saying that you're kind of ready to teach. I proposed an idea from Twitter. I don't know if any of you use Twitter, but some of you know we have blue checks next to our name, right? I proposed an idea where we get a little blue check if you'd been through the Center for Teaching Innovation diversity workshops, right? You wouldn't be required to do it, but you get a little blue check and then the students would know that you had had some training, right? The working groups, all of the working groups had students, and the students, if you think I'm radical, you should meet the students. I mean, this was a kind of adjustment and compromise from what the students wanted, right? So the students' perspective is, there's a lot of required courses in the university that they are required to take to fulfill their majors. And in those classes, they are exposed to various kinds of biased statements or, I mean, they can speak to it more articulately than I do. But it isn't, it's an incentive system. It's not meant to be a punitive system. It's a system meant to accredit you with having done some form of training, just like we already do for the search committee trainings. We're already doing it, right? This isn't, and if I can just say, I think it's much better if the faculty willingly adopt this rather than if we are told we have to do it. And in my experience, there's loads of people happy to tell academic faculty sitting in an Ivy League institution what we should be doing, right? It would be better if we adopted it. So that would be my case for it. I don't know if that's clarified, Carl, but thank you for asking.
Thank you for your words.
TJ?
Hi, thank you so much. And I mean, I think we all share the goal, maybe that this kind of training should be universal and ongoing. I just want to, it's just a core concern of mine. Well, one concern is that I've heard colleagues say that they will, on principle, refuse. And the other concern is that for people who have a glimmer that how important this training is, they're already doing it in some way. And if more options are out there, they will jump on them. But just having seen a couple of examples of training of that sort that was mandatory, I really saw it, the mandate producing itself, producing a begrudging attitude, and even a kind of violent rejection afterwards. And I think, you know, I would like everybody to take this training, but I'm a little bit concerned about, you know, a softer pressure in which this is a norm in the department, and which in, you know, gradually most people in the department have done different forms of this kind of training and discuss it in department meetings and in hallways, and create that kind of pressure on their colleagues to at least begin to feel that there might be gaps in their skill set and in their knowledge. That kind of atmosphere is quite different from what I've seen personally. When things are required and done with and then performed to tick off a box to get a little check on your something or other. And so that's a major concern of mine. I can personally live with a mandate. I'm just extremely worried about I think it should come from the faculty and not get plots done us from above. And it might, you know, some of my colleagues have been very concerned that they're already, you know, their colleges are already doing these kinds of things, and that these initiatives should look differently in different colleges. I think there was some of that already built into the report, but anyway, I would just push for something more like that. And I just want to give a shout out to Ken's point, which is that this kind of training, the training that I've seen work more effectively, that I've seen visible changes over time in people who underwent the training, was semester long, weekly lunch sessions, open-ended, problem-solving discussions, which is labor-intensive, but it really made a big impact.
Okay, thanks, TK. Let's we're getting now at the 4:30 point. Let's hear from Harold and Wendy, and then get back to how we process Richard's resolution. The question, think about this for a few minutes, which is, can you express yourself through the two resolutions, the UFC resolution and the Senate resolution? This was the plan, that we would hear these presentations and then in the e-vote, you would vote. So a question that I'd like the group to sort of help us answer is, can you express yourself adequately that way? Remember, this is communicating the body language of the Senate on all this stuff, okay? So let us go to Harold and then Wendy and then, Harold, yeah.
Well, I'd like to speak in favor of the, I guess it's called the faculty resolution, the one that didn't come from the UFC. I mean, the UFC report, it might not contain words like sanction or punishment, but I think it's obvious that it's all stick and no carrot. And unsurprisingly, professors don't like being told what to do. So I think if you feel that you're forced to go to a training session, think there's going to be automatic psychological response to not to engage with it in a productive way. So, I think this is just reiterating Reese's point, but the upshot is that I think we should go with the faculty resolution.
Okay, Wendy, then we'll go back to Richard and Wendy.
I guess I just want to go back to a question I posed earlier, which is, why is the program fundamentally voluntary for faculty and not for students and staff? And if you reply that it should be voluntary for everyone, then does this undermine all of the work of the working groups and it undermine the actual goals of the education programs? Because that to me is the tension that I cannot, like, I like all of the resolutions that were proposed, but it can't be weighed without looking at what is the program that the students are being asked to participate in, and what is the program that the staff are being asked to participate in. That's my comment.
Quick, Doug.
Doug?
Yeah.
Did quick, you say? Yeah. I don't understand how the faculty who can possibly oppose the UFC resolution. I'm a member of the medical profession, I'm credentialed, and I have to undergo periodic recertification. This is similar to that. We're all being forced to wear masks, to have testing every week for COVID. I just cannot understand how the faculty would not support our colleagues, our minority colleagues, who clearly feel very strongly that this kind of program sends a strong message to the university.
Okay, Richard, one suggestion I saw is that we would just put your resolution as an e-vote, and then we just have three different votes, or well, it would be part of that pool. That would solve a problem. In other words, everyone can weigh in as they see fit. And we have to move on to the other half of the program. But anyway, Richard, what are your thoughts?
Charlie, it has to have a vote now. It is the correct parliamentary procedure. I will insist that we have a vote on it. I do want to say a few things about the amendment and emphasize again that we have taken the best parts of the UFCF resolution and we have combined them with what we thought were the best parts of the faculty resolution. It is a composite then of those best parts. it does present to the Faculty Senate a clear choice between mandatory and voluntary compliance. We've heard a lot today about students and staff. Students and staff are important, but we can't legislate about them. We're a Faculty Senate. We could only legislate about faculty. The second point I would make is faculty are not staff or students. We have a particular role in society. We have a particular role in the university. It is supposed to have dissent. It is supposed to have different points of view. We should not be going to psychiatrists to have our heads examined in order to serve our job. That is not what the role of a faculty member is. And so when we're looking at this, a democratic choice between voluntary and mandatory, this should be made now. It should be made among colleagues, be made in public. It would be impossible to put it in an e-vote, but luckily that's not acceptable or possible under parliamentary procedure. Yeah. So we would have a vote now, and that's it.
I'm worried that can everybody, I haven't actually
Charlie,
seen
can it. I just, no. Can I just jump in for a second? Richard, even if we vote now, the count is really difficult because we need to check each person's vote against because we have a lot of people who are non-senators today in the meeting. So we can, even if we hold a vote in chat, Jill and I have to be checking this or somebody has to be checking this. And so we're not going to be able to have the count. You can have a vote. It will sit there and we will count after the meeting is over. Because we cannot confirm all, we have to check it against lists of senators.
Understood, Nima. The way it works is if the amendment were adopted, then that would be the resolution that goes to an e-vote. If the amendment were to fail, then the original UFC F resolution would go to an e-vote. So what we would be looking at, we vote now, we have a count, whatever that count is determined, would be determining which, whether the amended version or the original version goes to an e-vote. This is not a problem. And it is, I have to remind folks, you know, the democracy is messy sometimes, but it's really messy when the presiding officer is not neutral. I mean, this is a problem. So we really should, practice democracy, bottom up, spontaneous, real democracy.
Hey, Chris Schaefer, you had some ideas. It went by too quick in the chat. Do you have thoughts on how we can get out of this impasse here?
Hi, yeah, Chris Schaefer here. So I guess, Richard, the one thing I'm concerned with is if things move forward, as you suggest, it leaves very little distinguishing factors among the three different resolutions that would be e-voted on. Which doesn't leave much opportunity for the full views of the faculty to come out in this vote. I think a easier way to get the perspective of the faculty in a democratic way would simply be to formally amend your motion, withdraw it, and reintroduce your entire text as an alternative resolution that could be included in this e-vote as a fourth possibility. That would allow all of these perspectives to be on the floor. Richard, if you want to force a vote right now, I believe you do have the right to force that vote. Who would like to take the time to consider what you've put forward, I would vote against it if you force it right now, because I don't want to see the resolution that was produced put forward by the committee not have a straight up or down vote?
Chris, let me respond to that. I mean, we've been talking about this for a month now. You know, we've been back and forth. The major issue has always been whether it's mandatory or voluntary. People who have doubts about where they stand on that, I understand that, you know, more time might be needed. If you wanted to move that we postpone these whole proceedings until another meeting and we go through it again, if that's not the case, then we really should be voting. The issue before the Faculty Senate is whether compliance should be mandatory with punitive punishment of those who sincerely disagree, who dissent from whatever the administration decides to impose on us, which we do not know. That's one position. The other position is whether it should be voluntary and compliance should be compliance should be voluntary. That's a very stark issue. There's nothing really that I can see, especially once we've combined the two resolutions. There's nothing else that's dividing them. To be afraid in some way, to fear that the Faculty Senate would actually make a decision on the major issue that's before us. You know, we shouldn't be. This is a democracy. It's not ambiguous. To my mind, it doesn't take more time.
Richard, point of order. This is not about anxiety. Let's get back to the table where we can have discussion, please.
Okay. Anxiety.
I think we have to move on. Can we call for a vote on your resolution, and we'll put it in chat, and we'll count the votes. It might take a while, and then we go to get on with the other half of the meeting. Is that agreeable with you?
Currently, I object to this because it creates a bizarre situation where we're going to end up voting on the UFC motion without knowing which version we're actually voting on. Now, Chris's suggestion that there just be four votes avoids that ambiguity, and
right.
I think the ambiguity is very problematic.
Yeah, Ken, if I may interrupt for a minute. If we don't agree and we want to be able to take the UFC, if we want to be able to take the UFC resolution and the two faculty resolutions that we have already up on the DOF site, which Risa spoke to the two resolutions from the faculty, and Durba spoke to the resolution from the UFC. If we want to take those forward, all we have to do is vote no if we take a vote now. So if you don't agree, right, vote no. If you agree with Richard, vote yes. But we really need to move forward because we also have an entire set of resolutions to discuss around the student educational requirement, with enormous amount of work being put into that resolution as well. And so we can't hold this up. And so Joni's, you know, everybody's been speaking to this question. I think there's enough agreement. We don't need to keep reiterating the same point over and over again. We understand this is a democratic body. And so we will not have the resolution of the vote immediately, as I explained, because we have a lot of, even only senators may vote, but we need to check the votes against the list of senators. So it will take time for us to resolve this. But just if you know, unless again somebody yells out no really, really loudly, except for Richard, we can, you know, not because he will, of course, right? And so as he should, this is his motion. And so that if you're okay, if all of you are okay, I'm good. When I say so, just like, you know, I don't know, wave your hand if you're okay with it. If you're okay with it, we will just do the vote.
You've ignored two people's hands that have been up while this back.
Oh, I'm sorry. Whose hands were up? Sorry, Mark.
It was Ava Tarnish's hands up.
Okay, Ava.
For a long time.
I just want, I'm not a senator. I was on the F working group. And I guess I want to tell you guys one sentence. You know, no one asked to change your view. No one asked to examine your head. What's being asked that you spend an hour a semester thinking about a very important issue. And before you vote against this mandatory 1 hour a semester to think about a very important issue, please consider what the hell this will look like when staff are mandated to do this. The staff already are pissed. Then why are they mandated to do things? Why do we not trust them to be inclusive? And why do they have to do training? I think that this is a really good thing to think about it and talk about it for an hour and semester. It's a very minimal requirement. An hour is really short.
I'd like to call the question. Can I do that? I've had my hand up also. I've been wanting to respond to Doug's comment, and that if framing this about the people who are against, you know, the people who are in favor of the mandatory are those in favor of this education and believe it's important, and those who are not, who do not support the mandatory, are opposed to it. And that is an incorrect framing. What we're saying is that it is, people are passionate about this, and it is important. And infantilize faculty in this way just undermines the quality of our commitment and the reality of our commitment to this necessary education.
Have Stephen and Kelly heard the one summer story workshop?
We haven't.
That was the following week.
Okay,
Natasha. I'm done.
Let me see if we can go forward this way. If you want to, the plan was that we would have an e-vote over the next week. Departments were planning on talking about it, all right, over the next week. If you want to shortcut the discussion of Risa's resolutions and the UFC's resolutions, then vote for Richard's resolution. Why don't we do that right now?
Point of order. I think that you should state correctly what people are voting on. You've characterized what you think they should do. Yes, I think that what should be clear is that the vote would be yes or no on whether to amend the UFC resolution as Richard proposed. If people want to vote yes to amend that resolution, and if people vote yes on the amendment, then the e-vote will be on the amended resolution. If people vote no on the proposed amendment, then the UFC resolution will appear on the e-vote, as will all the other resolutions that have been posted.
So,
yes, I want to echo just what Risa said, and she said it better than I could. Charlie, it's very important to state what the question is correctly.
That's great. So I think Risa really clarified it. So I move that we vote on that in chat right now. Does that sound okay?
Yeah. Okay. So Charlie, are you going to say start and end, because we need to mark?
Yeah.
That.
Okay. So only senators. Okay. And no one put anything else in the chat until we say so. Okay. So again, the question is, Richard, you know, Richard's amendment and the way Risa described the implications for a yes and a no. So why don't we do that right now? So I'm not even, Jill, are you able to count votes and run the slides at the same time?
No, Charlie, I'm going to do it, but we have to still check it against the Senate list.
Yeah.
It's going to take a while. It may not happen before the end of the meeting.
Okay. Okay, so we'll tabulate these votes, and that will determine sort of what the e-vote looks like tomorrow. Okay, so why don't we now go on to the S resolutions? Okay. And where are we with the, okay, 10 to 5. Okay, so next slide, please. Okay, so just a real quick on a summary of the UFC's S resolution. Again, you've heard from us several times and so on. So just a little review here, because we're talking about, we are a research university, and this is we all know this little sequence. The research informs how we set up our majors. Majors get edited down into minors by knowledgeable scholars, and introductory courses can be thought of as snapshots of what shows up in the minor. Next slide, please. Okay. So in this particular area, there are six programs that are in play, okay? And this is the heart, the cornerstone of what's been called the literacy component, okay? And these six units, and you don't want to think of them as arts college departments, these are units that have faculty from all over the university, okay? And it's roughly speaking, the expertise in these units is perfect for the development of what we're calling the literacy component, okay? And again, the idea is that the faculty in these units, the researchers, would help shape this new curriculum. Now, you can think of the new curriculum as a central course or as an array of courses. Just think of it as resources that will then be made available some way, shape, or form to the to address the literacy component. But the working group, this is incredibly important. This is what would distinguish us from other schools who are working on this very same issue, but it's not enough. And this is where the skill, next slide, please, where the discipline part and the skill set part is also part of the proposal. So the UFC proposal is that entire box, okay? Part of it involves the literacy component, but there's a very strong emphasis also on work being done in the disciplines. Already that work is underway. You know, we're talking about colleges, schools, programs, departments. That work is underway, okay? The key thing in all these venues is students have to learn how to talk about this material with others and so on. So again, it's broad strokes. Remember, this is the recommendation phase. There are a zillion details associated with this. How this is rolled out, the inner workings of all that is something that has to be developed later. The key thing is, do you think those components are important? Do you think they warrant further further resources coming from, say, the provost to pursue these ideas that you see there? So that's sort of the overall view of the working group. Next slide, please. So we have a as usual, when we post resolutions, we get feedback. That's the way we do business, right? There's a resolution, we learn a little bit, and then you modify it. And the UFC would like to modify its report, not change anything other than to clarify some of the issues that surfaced, plus add in much more detail on the literacy part that was supplied by the six directors that you'll hear about. So I see a typo there. It's large enrollment course and so on. But all these things, so there's much more detail on the literacy part. Basically, that section has been expanded using the input that we received from those six directors. And then there was a little bit of a clarification about the connection between the skill set part and the literacy part. So again, consistent with how the interest in making sure everyone understands the essence of a resolution, putting it in more detail where there was none before or little before. That's the gist of this. So what we want here, next slide, is to sort of formally do this. Now, we told the other proposers that you can, on Friday or whenever, that, if you want to modify your resolution, that was fine. But we do are sensitive to the fact that this change should be done, sort of semi-formally. So again, all we have a modified report. It's up there. All we want to do is just change the reference in the resolution to the modified report, replacing the existing final report. It really doesn't even change the one pager. It's just simply more a clarification of things. So do we have a motion to second? Someone want to second this motion?
Yes.
Second.
Okay, great. Okay, and now the next slide, please. Does anyone want to discuss this? Does this seem like a reasonable thing? Does anyone find this not reasonable? They'd like to raise their hands and talk about it. Okay, next slide, please. Close anyone? So I guess we'll close the debate on this.
Chris has his hand up. Or
sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Charlie, at one point there had been a group that organized from some of these departments that brought forward some objections to the student requirements. I was just wondering the extent to which this revision of the report addressed some of those concerns that were brought forward, and in particular from the perspective of the ones that were concerned.
There were concerns from the six directors, okay, and our response to that was to add in, because we support their points of view on the, they had a great thing on role, how the program's going to be rolled out. We'll hear all about this in a second from the director group. And again, just a little bit of clarification on the skill set part. So hesitation about the working group's proposal is from the six directors, and they have an alternative proposal that addresses that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
I mean, there's the usual things about indoctrination, those sorts of things, at a much reduced level than we see with the faculty piece. Okay, so I guess we'll do another. Next slide, please. So again, a very quick Jill, a quick vote in the chat. Do you support the motion? And if you do, all that means is that the modified report becomes the basis for the working group recommendation. Okay, so we'll let that run for one or two minutes, and then. Okay, why don't we get set for the director presentation? So, Kurt, I think you could let's go to the next slide. And Kurt Jordan, are you here?
Yes, I'm here, Charlie. Christine is going to lead off.
Okay, great. So Christine, take it away, and Nima, Jill will run the slides for you.
Okay, sounds good. Next slide, please, Jill. So good now evening, everyone, and thank you to the senators for this opportunity to present our director's resolution. As Charlie mentioned, Kurt Jordan and I will be presenting today on behalf of our colleagues from the six programs and department that are listed here on this slide. So as some of you may have read in our open letter on the Faculty Senate comments, despite our expertise and established presence at Cornell, we were directly consulted relatively late in this process. We were not asked by the deans of faculty to meet together until this past January 19, 2021, when we were presented with an earlier draft of the Working Group S's report. In spite of a series of last minute meetings and tight deadlines, our group of six has worked collectively and met in good faith with Charlie and Nima over these past few months. We have also kept in communication with the senators group who you'll be hearing later from. And I just want to underscore these facts and thank my fellow directors for their spirit of collaboration throughout this process. Next slide, Jill, please. So just a brief rationale for our proposal. First, our proposal works to ensure that every Cornell student has a class with a professor for whom teaching about structural racism, sexism, and other forms of institutional inequality is their reason for being here at Cornell. To this end, we want to underscore the second point, that faculty in our units were hired, tenured, promoted, and now lead based on our expertise. We are committed to employing it in service to this institution in its current anti-racism efforts. Third, our faculty have the specific pedagogical knowledge and experience necessary to teach these difficult and delicate subjects. So as you've stated in earlier Senate meetings and meetings with the deans, the work of studying and teaching racism, anti-racism, colonialism, and decolonization actually requires a level of rigor and depth of analysis that we as scholars and teachers have crafted over years. In turn, throughout various iterations of this student requirements proposal, issues of campus climate, right, as affected by race and racism are also often highlighted. And I can say that as scholars, pedagogues, and directors, we and the faculty in our units are often the first, if not the only, to already deal with these issues in our classrooms, at our events, and of course, in our scholarship. Therefore, fourth, we do not see a separation between literacy and skills. We believe that academic rigor, which is the foundation of a Cornell education, is best achieved through the specifics outlined in our proposal. And finally, our proposal seeks resources to strengthen our units rather than leaving them in their current marginalized and overburdened condition. If the charge of this anti-racism initiative is to both enhance existing programs that promote racial justice and to think carefully about the role that we all must play in building a just anti-racist world, and these are all words from President Pollack's letter, then there would be no better anti-racist act for the administration to undertake when it comes to the student curricular requirement than the strengthening of our programs. Next slide, Jill, please.
Okay, so I'm Kurt Jordan from American Indian and Indigenous Studies, and I'm gonna talk through a little bit about the specifics of the proposal from the directors group. So, where our approach, one of the main components of it is that it culminates in a plan to offer a larger enrollment course on racism, anti-racism, colonialism, and decolonization to many students on campus. We have a rollout proposal that I'll talk about on the next slide, but we sort of, I think we see this as an open issue that we have a number of iterations where we would test this, and it may possibly end up serving as the sole means to fulfill the required course function, or it may end up being one option from a menu of courses. I don't think that we can predict that right now. There's certainly an awful lot of resources that would need to be developed to offer a campus-wide course. And we really need to see how this would be implemented to figure out how it might, whether that's really even a viable possibility. So certainly this would need to be developed gradually. Resources would needed to be provided in terms of faculty, TAs, administrative staff, that sort of thing to make it a reality. So we assert that representatives from our six units, alongside officers from the proposed anti-racism center, we really don't know how that will be implemented or what it will look like, but that we would evaluate additions to the list of approved courses. Next slide, please. So our proposed timeline, obviously we're in May already. The original intent was to try and do something, roll something out in fall 2021, and it is simply not logistically feasible to do that. So what we're planning here, or what we've come up with, is that we can direct interested students who want to take courses on these subjects to a menu of relevant introductory courses, all of which have no prerequisites. Some of them are fairly large enrollment courses already, and we have a list that we'll show you on the next screen. The other thing that we would intend to do is have a series of public presentations in a variety of formats. So there may be panels, there may be lectures, there may be podcasts, just a variety of different things that would be made available to the entire campus community. And I think we're sort of thinking about the Racism in America panel series that was offered this year as a kind of model. So this would be new programming. All of it would be offered in ways where it would be recorded and available to the full campus community. This, I don't think we see this as being sort of modules that could be exported to other units, because this is, this is not something that would be done, I think, in a really coherent, organized fashion, because we don't have time for that. But in fall 2022, we would offer an exploratory pilot large enrollment course. This would be taught in person. And we think that what would really be ideal, this is an unusual suggestion, but we think that we're really at the point where we need to think in new ways, that we would have representatives from each of our units, and we would have a six-way team taught course, so that, and there would be some provision where we would organize in spring 2022 to sort of develop our curriculum, figure out what we needed to talk about and the order that we would need to teach it in. So I think that this is a really interesting intellectual exercise, and it's one of the things that the directors group, I think, was really strong, we were very excited by this particular proposal. We do feel that this should be recorded, because we realize that we won't be able to offer a six-way team taught course forever, and that there may be segments of it that are very effective that were taught by a particular expert that we might be able to use in subsequent iterations of that in-person course. But we also saw those as sort of placeholders, and we saw a role for the production of higher quality versions of those segments that would be shot in studios, or perhaps even on location in a relevant place, either on campus or elsewhere. In spring 2023, we would do a second iteration of the exploratory course that would be team taught, but perhaps might use some of those videos from the previous fall. And then in fall 2023 and beyond, we would continue to offer this full version of a large enrollment course each semester, and then we would have to sort of consider the logistics of expanding it even beyond what we've talked about here. So next slide.
Yeah, and so again, we're just sharing here the roster of introductory courses that Kurt has mentioned. Courses that students next year in the 2021-2022 academic year could take if they're interested in courses on racism, colonialism, anti-racism, and decolonization. And then again, just to kind of underscore that we're open to any additions or actually even developing additional courses for the list. But that, again, based upon our expertise, the leaders of our six units and other representatives, including those from the proposed Anti-Racism Center, would be the ones to evaluate those additional courses. So that's it in terms of our formal presentation. And at this point, we just wanted to invite our fellow directors, Noli Wei-Rooks, Jane Juffer, and Vilma Santiago Irizarry, to join us in answering any questions you all might have.
Thanks, Christine and Kurt. So questions for the group? Joni?
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you for that presentation. A great presentation. I'm very excited by, I really support the idea of the area programs taking charge of this. And it sounds meaningful, engaging. I do have a question about why you envision, why you go for a large lecture course. Sometimes people think that, small seminars are better. Sometimes students think that large lecture courses are more meaningful, or, they're more serious, more important, or they're more boring. But I was just wondering, what were your thoughts about deciding for a large lecture course?
I guess I'm happy to answer that one. I think we're thinking about reach. These definitely would have small in-person discussion sections. But I think if we sort of had a small seminar approach, we would need to do something on the scale of the freshman writing program. And that's obviously, we're talking about strengthening our units. I don't think we're imagining something of that magnitude. I don't know if others of the director's group would add to that.
I would say lecture courses are great for breadth, and seminars are better for depth. If we're going to cover information that comes out of all of our programs, we need the breadth, right? And then what we would try to do is encourage, not require, but encourage, given the strength of our pedagogy, given, again, the breadth of what's offered, students who want to go more in depth to do so. I also just want to add one thing in support of our proposal. There's a quote that's big in my house. It's from a performer named Sun Ra, who has passed. And what he says, and what my husband and I often say to each other, is the possible has been tried and failed. It's time for the impossible. Right. And that's big in my house, because so often when we talk about the kinds of issues that we're talking about here, we run smack up against, how are you going to do that? What do the resources look like? How will you convince people? Right. The ability to dream beyond what hasn't worked is what's animating us right now. And what we know from information that has been placed on the Dean of the Faculty website that Nima or Charlie put up is that in the 20th century, these same issues have come up repeatedly, the same kinds of concerns, the same kinds of asks. And when Cornell faculty has chosen to respond, they've responded in a decentralized, let departments do what they want, let faculty do what they want, don't centralize, don't raise up certain people, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Or we hear a version of a libertarian, what about my rights? What about me? It hasn't worked, because then in the 21st century, we find ourselves with multiple instances of the students saying the same thing. We've tried what we know how to do. We've tried it. Cornell has tried it. The colleges have tried it. The schools have tried it. It hasn't worked. It's time for the impossible. We recognize this is big. We recognize this is out of the ordinary. But we're willing to try, because it's time. It's time to take ourselves beyond our comfort zone. It's time to take ourselves beyond what we know to do, what we think we know. Because what I'm telling you is, the numbers of times that our students keep coming back to us, they're telling us we do not. So at the very least, let's take a leap here. Like, let's try the impossible.
Yeah, and I think just to amplify what Noli Wei just said, and to respond to Joni, and to again highlight what Kurt has said, part of what excited us about the big lecture course, is the fact that it could be team taught, that we could actually, as you know, these six units have a kind of comparative analysis, a kind of conversation, right, across the kind of silos that we have been operating under for the last decade. So
going down the list, Harold Landon, then Harold.
Yeah, so I mean, this resolution sounds great, but there's one thing about it that I find kind of puzzling. I'm not saying I find it troubling, but it's puzzling because the focus seems to have widened from anti-racism to anti-structural inequality. So, I mean, is that intentional? Is the idea here to go from a narrow focus to a wider focus? I'd like more clarity about that.
I don't actually know what anti-structuralism means. Like the words that you're using, I'm not actually understanding.
Well, it was a remark about structural inequality. Now that's much broader than addressing structural inequality is much broader than addressing anti-racism. It would involve, for example, addressing sexism. So, and I'm sure other isms that I'm not thinking about at the moment. So I just want to be clear about this widening of the scope is what's intended.
I think that the simple answer would be no. So within an anti-racist initiative, if I use a term or we use a term like structural inequality, I guess we would assume that you would understand that the what we're talking about is, you could certainly bring other things in and I'd be fine with it. But I think as we discussed it, this was not like all bad things. We're not proposing to teach all bad things in the class. Oh, that's my two cents.
I think to what Harold's saying, I mean, I think part of also the breadth is I want to look at the terms that we use in our proposal, which are histories of colonialism and processes of decolonization, right? So that, you know, I think the term, I mean, this is me speaking personally, the term anti-racism has a certain import right now in this moment. But again, as people who've been studying these histories for decades, you know, they do have a longer history and they do have a wider breadth, right? So to be simply an anti-racist kind of educational requirement doesn't actually really meet the needs or address, right, the situation that our country's in and our world is in right now.
Someone asked about FGSS. I don't know if Jane wants to, if Jane is here.
Jane's here. Right
well,
now.
I can also add something because the thing is that racism is encompassed through structural inequality. And then there's also intersectionality in which different forms of inequality reinforce each other. So this is where sexism, homophobia, racism, and so on intersect.
Okay, Landon.
I just want to say I'm really excited about this. This was kind of the type of thing that I would hope to have seen when we were talking about training for students. So I just want to say that I'm very excited about this. And I also want to say that I'm glad that you're considering other courses that are taught in the university. So I'm in the Department of Sociology and we have like the Center for the Study of Inequality. A lot of the courses that would probably be most relevant to this are already cross-listed with your units. But I just want to highlight that, you know, I'm excited and I think there's good ways of, you know, kind of capitalizing on what Cornell is already offering and then expanding that. And I'm very excited about this and think this is a great way forward.
And I would also add the large lecture course to your point that we are proposing actually is inspired by that large inequality course, which I would say it is not that we cross-list a lot of courses that you teach. Those courses actually originate with our program. I think Africana offers more courses that are a part of the inequality major. I know FGSS and LSP's courses really make up the bulk of it. So just wanted to clarify, it's the other way around. We're offering the courses and it's kind of benefiting sociology. So we also saw this as a way of evening that out some.
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much for clarifying that. I appreciate it.
Lauren.
It's a very quick question, and thank you for your presentation. I also appreciate the fact that you are encompassing more than just the six program and units. Is there a graduate studies component in what you presented? Because the list is only a list of classes for undergrad. So I was wondering if you had considered that, if you had ruled it out.
We have just a very brief mention in there. I think that we realize that the president's task included graduate education. I think we have a sentence in the proposal that sort of says we have to think about this one harder. So I think that we had, you know, we had the most traction in our group thinking about undergraduate education. I think that was a placeholder that indicates we have to do more thinking and work to consider what's going on with grad students.
Yeah, I also think that the graduate training here at Cornell operates on the committee system. And so there's a certain degree of autonomy in graduating the special committees that basically shape and guide graduate training that will have to be taken into account.
Charlie, if I could just follow up with what Wilma just said, just so everyone's aware, when we talk about graduate education, we include master's professional, master's research, and PhDs. So there are, and in terms of scale, we're talking about 14,000 undergraduates and about 10,000 graduate students.
Risa?
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. I wonder, I think it would be useful if you could perhaps crystallize the differences between your proposal and the way in which the UFC modified report has adopted part of your proposal and what you see as the key differences.
I'll start us off. So one of the things is we are, the UFC proposal is still really holding on to this idea of autonomy in the disciplines, autonomy in colleges, autonomy with professors, that there would be materials that are made available. And as a part of this project, one of the ways to fulfill this charge is professors, colleges, units can pick and choose what they want to. They would have, I guess, IDC, is that still in there? They have the intercultural dialogue with grad students leading discussions. And that seems to stand alongside this idea of a course that is a 4-credit semester long course. We're fine, like what we are saying is that we want to say that it is deeply encouraged. We cannot require, we recognize that at this point it would take years to align everybody's curriculum to say you have to, but that's a worthy kind of goal. But we're saying everyone should be encouraged to take one of these courses. And then whatever the colleges want to do, I don't even think, like, we're fine with after that. What we're concerned with is there's a semester long course taught by faculty who are best able to do it, that is offered to the greatest number of students, as opposed to this piecemeal thing where you have grad students and different faculty with different interests able to shape whatever they want to, however they want to. We're saying that these are fields of study. There's curriculum, like there's decades of work, just sort of saying, get some grad students to watch some videos and have some chat. And maybe you do a discussion guide, you know, maybe you try to tell them some questions to ask. Seems to me at a school like Cornell, where rigor is supposed to matter, it just comes up short. So that's the fundamental difference. We don't see it as let everybody do anything willy-nilly.
I want to offer Jane. I don't know if you wanted to talk to the response to also the skill set outcome language of the working group S.
Jane?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I think one still significant difference between the two reports is that the directors object to the distinction between the literacy component and the skill set component. And our concern there is that the kind of critical content that we produce will then get disseminated into different departments and disciplines. And that in that transference, there's going to be a loss of the critical component and more of an emphasis on a skill set, which we think kind of diverges or digresses into kind of corporate diversity discourse. And so that's our real concern.
Thanks, Jane. Chris.
I just wanted to raise what I had seen as an alternative way of thinking about this sort of in the disciplines requirement. I'm in biomedical engineering, for example. And one thing that I think it'd be very important for us to teach the trainees in our major are about the existence of and factors that have contributed to health disparities in this country and around the world. I very much saw the ideas that were put forward in the proposal as investing in the right places in the university to create structures and programs that would help us be able to develop high quality content that was tailored to how anti-racism perspectives could benefit these trainees when they go out, or these students when they go out into the world.
Let me say, we're not opposed to units. We would encourage units to do whatever works for them. What we're saying is students need a baseline, and we understand that this adaptation, if faculty don't have the skills, there's no shortcut to it. That's what we're saying. There's no shortcut to understanding the pedagogical and intellectual field. We want to offer an intro course, basically, if you think about it like that. We want to offer a base, a ground. What grows up out of that, we're not saying, oh, engineering can't do anything else. Sure, you know, adapt it. But we believe that students need a semester-long course laying out what these fields are, what these topics are, that they can also probably then have some kind of say in how they'd like to see it adapted. It's not all coming then from top down. Perhaps they'd leave our class and say, you know, I'd like to see some more about how this works or that works. And then they can work in collegially with faculty in their units. We're not opposed to people adapting, but we're saying that there has to be, to our mind, a course that's an actual degree granting course in these fields. And that to not do that, feels like it's not just a missed opportunity for the university, but that it may be that our colleagues literally do not understand what we do. You do not understand the fields that we work in. You don't understand what we're teaching students. If you can say, we're going to have an anti-racism course where people who don't do, they may do topics, they may do specific topics, but who don't do this are now responsible for teaching. Like that doesn't make sense to us. Or to me, I don't want to speak for everybody else, but for me, I find that confusing.
Yeah, thank you, Noloway. And if I could just ask for clarification, as I read the new new proposal, it sounds like it is this 3 to 4 credit large enrollment course with the development timeline similar to what you proposed, and then in addition, it is a push for, and I would assume then provost level resources for this partner development of in the discipline courses. I just want to be clear about what we're voting on.
Okay.
I guess, Chris, that question would be for Charlie or the folks in the working group who've modified, right, their own report.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Sorry, Chris, were you asking for what the modified, I understood it as you're asking the directors
No, I was asking for the folks that produced this modified report. Again, I read the modified report in very much as saying the large required, the large enrollment taught by experts required course is a part of it. And then that there's a additional resources that go beyond that. And I see Nola way shaking her head one way and you saying the other thing. So I really think we should try to have some clarity. Yeah.
Okay, so we see hands up, and if it's still not clear at the end of everybody else speaking, we can speak to that.
Chiara, yes. Then Neil, then Eric. Chiara.
Yes, I just wanted to speak as a member of the working group for the student requirement to answer Chris's question. So we took the proposal from the directors very seriously, and we were actually quite, I'm going to say, enthusiastic about the fact that they were willing and interested and saw the opportunity in taking care of the literacy part. And we took that and we retained the second part, which is exactly what you are talking about, which is an infrastructure in which we ask for resources so that departments can also tackle the questions that you were pointing at. So how do questions of structural inequality in its multiple manifestations, as we've talked so far, affect specific fields so that we train majors into not just thinking in compartmentalized way or just to think that this is something that affects society, but actually also affects the field in which they are being trained, and also has the graduate students component. It's more deeply fleshed down in a sense, because we were aware that the mandate for the reports was also to focus on graduate students, not just on the undergraduates, while understanding obviously that there are challenges in implementation because various colleges and schools have their own structures, but we try to figure out how to give space to each of these aspects of the mandate. I hope that clarifies the question.
Thanks. Neil, then Eric. Neil.
Hi, I just have a question for clarification. I was looking at the report and then hearing the account given of it today by the directors, and I was wondering exactly what the relationship is of the required course that you're developing to the other courses that you're also imagining could possibly fulfill the requirement. And maybe this is tailing on Chris's question, I'm not really sure. So I think the wording was that the work that you're doing to develop this course would be a required course or an option from a menu of courses. And so could you explain that? Because it sounds like you're doing all this work to put together a required course and it's just gonna be one course among many that is an option. I happen to favor myself several different courses rather than one. But I would just like to know what your can you clarify that a little bit for me?
This question of menus, especially over in CALS, has taken up a lot of time. People are kind of like, well, over in CALS, we have 300 courses that do the exact same thing. Again, the students are still saying, you know, something is needed here. So, and so we were just pointing out, we also have courses that, you know, students could take if they want to, but our big contribution here is saying that we need a semester long, to the extent that you can require a required course taught by the experts. That there's nothing in our report that suggests that there's a substitute for that. And I think that's where one of the differences between our report, which we actually didn't know that the working group was going to take our report and then put it into their report. Like that was a complete surprise to us when you know, we sent them the draft and they were like, look here, now we're doing it. But there's still some parts of, you know, like what we're offering that I think it is really different, and that's one of them. We believe there needs to be a semester-long course taught, because the other courses don't cover the breadth, they're not covering the regions, they're not covering the time periods. You know, like if you take Intro to Africana Studies, which I've taught before, you're going to get one view of anti-racism, but you're not going to get an intersectional view. You're not going to see how that relates to the Latinx experience. You're not going to get, you know, some of the more intersectional things if you just take the one that we're offering. So we're saying we have the opportunity to put together something that has real depth and breadth, and that should be the focus, and that is equally as important as what individual professors or colleges want to do. And so we're asking for centralization in our report, quite frankly, when all the others are saying we don't want centralization, we reject it. And we're hearing that centralization should be rejected because, you know, the Board of Trustees and the administration and the deans have no interest in it. And part of what's animating our conversation is this is our moment to say what faculty would want. We can work out what deans and administrators are thinking, what the Board of Trustees wants to do later. We understood this to be for faculty to put forward our best faith effort about what we thought would serve the students. And that's what we've done.
May I have a follow-up question? So again, I'm still not really sure. So are you saying that colleagues in CALS who've been teaching courses that could cover the anti-racism topic in their courses for years, and I've been in contact with CALS colleagues who said, you know, they've had various people teaching courses, as you've mentioned, on the curriculum for many, many, many years. Are you saying that those people teaching those courses should not be credentialed to teach those courses? Or only courses that are credentialed by the people in the programs are the ones that should? This is, and I'm not, I don't mean this in a critical way. I'm just trying to be clear about what it is that you're.
And if somebody else wants to jump in, because, you know, I'll talk, not a problem.
Again, I don't, please don't take this as a kind of criticism. I'm just trying to clarify what we're voting on.
It seemed collegial. I am not
insulted. Thank you.
It seemed like a reasonable question. Yeah, I'm sorry if I gave you some impression that it was somehow offensive. I didn't.
No, I don't want to be
in the least. The thing that we're saying is that in our fields of study that are really delving deeply into institutionalized racism across time, across region, across space, there's an expertise in teaching the whole of it, the breadth of it. We are in no way suggesting that we are the only people who know anything about race, that we are credentialed to tell other people what they do or do not know about racism. What we're saying is we know what our fields have to offer. Mm-hmm. We understand the training and the credentialization, and that we would like that to be respected. We're not trying to stop other people, but we're saying there needs to be a survey course in the same way that there's intro to whatever the rest of us teach. That doesn't mean the person teaching that intro course is the keeper of all knowledge about everything in that discipline forever, that's the only way to do it. But there is a value to teaching with that kind of breadth. And that's what we're
offering. I totally agree.
Just that. And then after that, the people in the departments who have expertise, you run. I feel like I'm talking a lot. Y'all talk. I'll stop. I'll mute.
No, I want to just follow up, Nolia, with the comment, and actually in a response to Simone's earlier question from 30 minutes ago, in regards to, you know, the fear that somehow the folks in our six units are only focused on US-based or US contemporary. I'm speaking for myself. I'm also have affiliation with Southeast Asian studies. And I firmly believe that one cannot understand the Asian American experience or the Asian experience in America without understanding policies and histories and wars, right, that were fought overseas in Asian countries. So again, I think, you know, something that Noliwe mentioned earlier, this kind of like, perhaps our colleagues need to know a little bit better the ways in which we do our own research, the ways in which it is already engaging with the global and other spaces, and longer historical timelines than just the contemporary.
Let's do Eric, then Mark, and then get on to the Senator S. proposal. Eric.
Yeah, so I'm a member of the American Indian Indigenous Studies Program, former director of that program, and I was also on Working Group S. And as everybody knows, what I proposed was that people would take a series of requirements from all of these six programs. They would take one course in each of those programs, and that would suffice for the requirement. That way they would get an intersexual look at things, but through separate courses that were on the books and that would be created. And of course that was rejected because there was not room in the Cornell curriculum for those kinds of requirements. One of the things that I stated early on was that I thought this was an opportunity for Cornell to look at its fundamentally Eurocentric curriculum and start to think about redesigning that Eurocentric curriculum, but that's not on the books either. So we're down to one centralized course now. I'm for an intersectional large lecture course. My question about it, given the constraints and the fact that we're trying to shoehorn this one course, wherever it's coming from, into this curriculum, which does not want to give much room to this kind of material, is the implementation of that course and the distribution of it so that all undergraduate students at Cornell can take it. That still seems to me to be unclear how that can be done. And until there's a clear path to doing that, I support a menu that clearly has the six directors on the committee that decides what that menu will be. That proposal will be presented subsequently. So those are my thoughts. I think it's unfortunate that Cornell will not examine the Eurocentric status of its curriculum in a serious way that would allow for students to take in a required way, since we require all sorts of things at this university, that would allow students to take required courses in these fields.
Okay, thanks, Eric. Mark, and then we'll go on to the Senator S. proposal. Mark.
Thanks, Charlie. So I have a question, but I will say that I appreciate what Nolue Brooks' point is about the fact that some of us don't have the expertise to teach those kind of courses. I mean, I've been African-American my whole life, and I certainly couldn't have written Cutting School, and I appreciate that someone else can do that for us. So I guess my concern is, what if I look at the required resources you're asking, and what if you don't get all of them? Is there some way you're going to prioritize what's going to be done? Because it seems like you're asking for a lot, and I'm worried that what you may get is not all of that. And then we're stuck with a part of this, and we need more. So what's the answer to that question? Thank you.
So let me say, this kind of relates to something Carol Boyce Davis put in the chat. You know, but budgets are documents that speak to priorities. And saying that what we don't have is the condition that our programs are in, we will not bore you with the tiny shoestring budgets that we have. And then tell you about what we do with that. And so that's a part of the reason that we're saying that this university, you can't just say, we want to raise up this kind of issue, we want to solve it. And that's why I started by saying, let's do something different. What we've been doing, you know, is we don't have the money. Let's outsource, let's do something different. Let's ask us, we've been thinking about this, ask us what we need to be successful. Find out what that is. Let's think creatively about how to get us there. When we decide that we want a new school of public policy, you know, it was a multi-year process. It was a lot of meetings. It was a lot of goodwill, but we figured out how to get there. Budgets, the absence or presence of money is all about choices. And we think that this is worth supporting. We're not saying, somebody said you're going to need 100 TAs. That's just like ridiculous. Like no one's, you know, like, again, ask us what it is we think we need, but our programs have got to be strengthened. Otherwise, what's going to happen is we're all going to be doing inequality studies. We're all going to be doing, like, you know, everybody's running around doing whatever. And our programs with the most expertise, with the majority of people of color in and around them, are suffering. It's a retention issue. It's a PR issue. It's a pedagogical issue. It's a rigor issue. It's a chance for Cornell to actually lead, not give lip service, but actually lead by asking, what would it take for us to realize this? It won't be cheap, but we're willing to get it started. We have a path to get it started that actually is not requiring very much. We don't want to leave it there. We don't want to shoulder all of that. But what we have in there about how to roll it out, that's rolling it out with the resources we currently have and who's on the ground. We can see it. And we're just asking to the chance to make the case.
Okay, thanks, Nala. Yep. Okay, so let's get back on the slides for the last presentation. Lauren, this is the Senator S proposal. Incidentally, Jill, as we're at the Zoom run, how long can the recording go? Is it 3 hours, or is there a limit? Anyway, let's just keep going until the tape runs out. So, Lauren, you're up.
Okay, thank you. Actually, I will be speaking with Carol Boyce Davis as well, who will present the second slide. I mean, we will be as brief as we can. We have only two slides. This first one is for me. So some of you have heard me in the Senate saying repeatedly that I was an advocate of the free curriculum, absolutely free curriculum. I'm completely an advocate of that. I understand that I might be the only one in the entire university. So I'm trying to be practical. If we are requiring something, then what should we require? And I have to preface that by saying that what we have been doing, what these committee of senators and other faculty have been doing, is stemming from the very critical reading we are doing of the report coming from the committee that Charlie said to me 2 weeks ago that it would never reconvene, even though we saw that it's resurrected from the dead, which is an interesting case. At any case, if we are asking for mandatory education for students about anti-racism, what do we want to do? I believe we should, at the university level, not at the college level as such, we should have a very strong scholarly content, because that's what this is about. We should have a class or a seminar, a real one. And these class seminars should be taught by people who know what they're talking about, people who have been studying racism and colonialism. So that's a commonality with what you heard before. So based on the agreement we had last meeting with Carol Boyce Davis about these core values, I would say, I wrote to her last week, and we both crafted a resolution with Risa's help, not knowing that there had been another resolution against the report as it stood at the time that had been prepared by Thomas Bjorkman, Ryan Chabot, and Nils Akamano and others. And when we heard about that, we tried to create a convergence. It's clear that the other resolution was more decentralized than what we were doing. So we came to a compromise that we thought would be valuable. And then over the weekend, we learned that there was the presentation you just heard. And we have been in touch with the directors over the weekend and until yesterday night, actually, over email. So we didn't have enough time to see our view converging, and maybe it wouldn't be possible completely with at least some of us, but you will see that we are now really looking at the content, and the content will be introduced to you in the next slide by Carol Boyce Davis.
Hi, everybody. Carol Boyce Davis. I'm in an interesting position because I'm in Africana and literature is in English. So a part of me supports the initiative that was presented by the former group, but I see a lot of limitations in terms of the execution of it, and I can see more about that. This resolution supports requiring that all students before graduation complete at least one full credit course addressing race, indigeneity, ethnicity, and bias already taught in the departments and programs or newly created. placing implementation of the course requirements primarily in the schools and colleges as required by Cornell bylaws, bringing university-level faculty governance into the implementation through support from faculty senate committees and example, as you can see, and ad hoc committees of faculty currently invested in research on structural racism, colonialism, and injustice, including Africana, American Studies, American and Indigenous Studies, Asian American Studies, Feminist, Gender, Sexuality, and Latinx Studies. So in my reading of this, teaching and studying race is a very specialized field. Not everybody in Africana Studies automatically can do that or any of those other fields. People have studied race, written about the history of it, the psychology of it, the you know, the historic ways in which race has been configured under Western civilization and so on. And of course, the ways in which it's been distorted, the way that racism works, is a whole set of fields. So I don't think we just automatically assume because people are Black or of color, they automatically have the expertise to teach this subject. So in my view, if this is the first position that's going to work, the last one that was proposed, which I hope it does, it will need for the university to really hire people who have expertise, training, publications, knowledge, and study of race so they can actually teach it properly. I don't see, kind of, for example, in this proposal that was submitted earlier, has only the intro to Africana studies as an option. This semester, and I do try to include a lot of discussions that have to do with all those components, bringing in the Caribbean as much as I can, Latin America, Africa, and the US as well. So it takes a great deal of negotiating to do that. And I'm not sure in a big floppy course that's possible to do it in a good way, unless you have people who are really absolutely trained and able to do that. Unless in their proposal, the idea is that they will create a structure where over the summer or over a period of time, people are trained in how to talk and teach about race. Otherwise, there are a lot of complications and problems in my understanding about how that is delivered. As it is, I'm not sure that many faculty in Africana, for example, I would be happy if they were teaching race right now in the way that this is proposed. They'd have to be retrained for sure. They'd have to understand all the dynamics of how to do this properly as opposed to just, you know, pulling together a big floppy course that is going to be taught in the way that is proposed. But I'm hoping if that option works, as I said, I'm partially in support because I understand the logic of it. And I have been a director of an Africana Studies program before, so I technically support. But if it would have to be really built in deep resources, hiring many more faculty hires in all of those departments in order to make this work. And I think that would be probably for me, high on the agenda right now. If this is, it should be accompanying, I should say, the proposal, and not just an assumption that it can be done with whoever is there right now.
Thanks, Carol. Questions for Carol or Lauren?
We also have other senators here with us who participate in the writing.
Anyone want to speak up? So let's see. Nima, did you want to mention? I think we have some preliminary results from the two votes we had.
Yeah, okay. So the motion that Richard Bensel brought forward has been voted down. And these are provisional counts, please. These are not final counts because we have to check against, you know, for repetition as well as we have to check against a list of senators. So a provisional count is that the motion that Richard Bensel brought to the floor or to the Zoom room has been voted down, 56 to vote it down and 22 to take it forward. So we will not be taking that. I mean, so that will not be moving forward. The motion for considering the S modified proposal as the basis for the UFC vote has been accepted. 57 yeas, 3 noes, and 14 people abstained. And these are, I'm underscoring, provisional votes because we Jill has to, and I have to still check these against the list of senators. So we will be going forward with the S modified proposal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Risa, you had your hand up?
Thanks. I actually had it up for the last resolution, and I got a little mixed up with my computer here.
That's fine. ask away.
Yeah, well, I was one of the co-sponsors of the resolution, and I just wanted to emphasize that what that resolution was really trying to do, I think that both Laurent and Carol explained, you know, both the process we went through as well as, you know, to put it together, as well as some of the substantive concerns that we had. And I wanted to just emphasize that that resolution was trying to really put out as something very rich the many courses that we have, right? Everybody was in agreement that having a requirement of at least one course that students need to take addressing race, indigeneity, ethnicity, and bias is a very good idea, and we support that. But that to also emphasize that there are courses across this university that are really excellent at teaching in that area. And so it seems to me, and I was thinking about Neil's question, that, you know, when I read the report from the directors, I also read it as saying that there could be, you know, this one large course created, and that it could be a choice among other choices for people to fulfill the requirement. It would be even better if students would go on and take more courses, but that Cornell in many of the colleges and schools, including my own in ILR, I think we have a really rich selection of courses that could fulfill that requirement. And so this was trying to emphasize that along with the governance aspect to say that the faculty senate committees, and we recommend an ad hoc committee, as you saw in terms of the language of the membership of the ad hoc committee, should be looking at how the implementation could take place that would enable the larger class if people want to create that, but also have that alongside of a roster of courses that could fulfill a requirement if we only have one requirement for students.
Okay, thank you, Risa. So let's see. I'm not sure if everyone, all the chat questions, maybe there's some unanswered questions or whatever. What we'll try to do is make sure the presenters see all the queries that were posed. They probably already do already. Then I want to stress that we have a resolution page for every one of these six resolutions, and that you can modify there's a background section in there if you want to preface the resolution with some comments that are driven by what was discussed today. That's all fine. And we'll also set up the Qualtrics vote and make sure that it squares with everybody's, all the proposers' understanding of what we're doing. So are there any other things about process here? So in other words, we're going to digest all this material. It'll be online. We'll have a week, right? It's not like you have to vote on Friday. We have all through next week. Meetings with your units and so on. We'll have all the information up online probably by tomorrow morning over the chat and so on. And the time has come to vote. We've talked a lot about these things. It's tricky. It's complicated. And remember, we never were ever going to send some crisp little message to the president and provost. It's going to be an array of opinions. And don't forget, you have that little comment box. And maybe it sounds kind of corny, but it is important. You're going to vote some way, and you can sort of either give a rationale or express some kind of hesitancy about it. And somehow in the collection of all these votes and those comments, some kind of pattern or some kind of faculty, some sense of how the faculty are thinking will emerge. Having said that, I think thank you very much for this is the world's longest Senate meeting, 2.5 hours. It's also, we've never had so many Senate meetings in a year as this one. So I'm setting all kinds of records. But again, just a reminder that these are difficult, tricky things. And I always think that we're at a better place after these meetings. And so thank you very much. And we'll be in touch.